sweeter now than the wildest dream. Could have seen her, and I watch her slipping away. But I know I'll be hunting high and low.
Welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is October 1st, 2014, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Hunting High and Low, Best Map in Septic Patients. And I have not one, but two guest skeptics today. I have Aaron Brennan and Stuart Douglas, who are emergency medicine residents at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, Canada. Welcome to the SGEM, Aaron and Stuart.
Thanks, Ken. Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
As you may be able to tell, we are recording this live with the Queen's EM department. We have residents. And we have staff. So I wanted to get some information from both of you. And the question that I wanted to ask before the podcast started is, what's the best part of the Queen's EM program? Stu?
Queen's EM is great. The best part of our program comes from having a small, tight-knit group of residents. Also a tight group of staff. Because of this, they get a lot of confidence with you quicker, you get a bit of more of a leash in the emerge. And we live in cottage country, that's pretty good too.
And Aaron, what do you think the best part of being in the Queen's EM program is?
So I totally agree with everything Stu mentioned. In addition, my personal favorite thing about doing emerge at Queen's is the yearly Big Mac Challenge, which is a bike race combined with speed eating a Big Mac meal.
Yeah!
Well, for me, as an outsider coming to your university, I think the best part of Queen's EM program is having a great mentor like Heather Murray, who invited me to come. She clearly cares about the program and the students. So let's start this podcast off with a case scenario.
The following case is one that every EM provider will be familiar with, but one in which the subtleties of management may differ greatly. So a 74-year-old man is brought by EMS for altered level of consciousness. He lives alone, family haven't heard from him in several days, so went to check. Found him to be coughing and mildly confused. The EMS vitals are heart rate 115, respirate 24, blood pressure 103 on 70, oxygen 89 on room air and 99% on non-rebreather, with a temperature of 38.4. Blood glucose is normal. The patient's not intubated, wishes no CPR, but does want full medical management. And the past medical history includes COPD, type 2 diabetes, hypercholesterolemia, hypertension, and PVD, peripheral vascular disease.
So the patient is triaged to one of your acute care beds, IV access is obtained, and a standard bolus of 1 liter normal saline is provided. The ECG shows sinus tachycardia, and a portable chest x-ray demonstrates a right lower lobe infiltrate. Lab tests are drawn and sent, and you start early goal-directed therapy as per your institution. You've rapidly recognized that this man is septic, given IV fluids, and administered appropriate IV antibiotics for his pneumonia. Now you're starting to think about fluids, vasopressors, what kind of a map you're going to be targeting, and you're left with some questions.
So the question we want to answer on today's podcast is, does a map of 80 to 85 decrease 28-day mortality as compared to a map of 65 to 70? But before we answer that question, we need to give some more background information on sepsis.
So sepsis remains a major contributor to ED mortality, carries a short-term mortality of approximately 20%. With approximately 750,000 annual cases in the U.S., recognition and early treatment of severe sepsis and septic shock has become a pillar of emergency medicine.
So can you give me a definition of sepsis?
So sepsis can be defined as a clinical syndrome complicating severe infection characterized by inflammation remote from the site of infection. Dysregulation of the inflammatory response can lead to multiple organ dysfunction.
Now there's a continuum of sepsis ranging from SIRS, which is systematic inflammatory response syndrome, to septic shock.
Yeah, that's right. So SIRS has a criteria for the definition. Being temperature under 36 or over 38 degrees Celsius, heart rate over 90, resp rate over 20, or a PaCO2 under 32, and white count under 4 or over 12, or greater than 10% immature forms. Sepsis is 2 of the 4 SIRS criteria plus an infection. Severe sepsis is sepsis with hypotension and end organ failure. And finally, septic shock is sepsis and hypotension refractory to fluid treatment.
Now, you mentioned MAP, or mean arterial pressure. What is MAP, and how do you measure or calculate it?
Yeah, so MAP is an important parameter for patients, and it's the average arterial pressure during a cardiac cycle, which represents the perfusion pressure seen by the organs and tissues. So it equals the cardiac output times the systemic vascular resistance plus the CVP, or can be estimated loosely by 2/3 the diastolic pressure plus 1/3 the systolic pressure.
Now talk to me about surviving sepsis and this early goal-directed therapy.
Basically, sepsis management involves early recognition and early intervention. Rapid administration of broad-spectrum antibiotics and then titrating the pathogen, and a sequential approach to fluid administration to CVP targets, vasopressor administration to MAP targets, and packed red blood cells transfusion to hematocrit and SVO2 targets has resulted in marked improvements in survival. Recent studies, like PROCESS, have indicated that invasive blood pressure monitoring actually might not be required as previously thought.
Well, I'll put a picture of the original early goal-directed therapy by Dr. Rivers in the blog posting. So your question of the podcast, though, is about having a higher MAP target. Where did the hypothesis come from? A higher MAP may be better than a lower MAP?
Yeah, so there's been some work looking at MAP targets in patients with sepsis. So Dunser et al. In 2009 found in a retrospective cohort study that a MAP below 75 was associated with an increased need for renal replacement therapy. And Baden et al. In 2011 found in a prospective cohort study that in patients presenting with septic shock and renal impairment at baseline, MAP targets between 72 and 82 resulted in less acute kidney injury.
So what's the article we're going to review to address the question of high versus low MAP?
The article we chose was Asfar et al., high versus low blood pressure target in patients with septic shock.
And people are cheering because he pronounced the name correctly.
Woo.
So what population were we dealing with in today's study?
So this study looked at 29 centers in France, had a total of 776 patients, and they included patients over 18 years with septic shock refractory to fluids who required vasopressors at greater than 0.1 mics per kilo, evaluated within 6 hours of initiation of pressors.
They define septic shock as 2 or more diagnostic criteria of the systemic inflammatory response syndrome, proven or suspected infection, and sudden dysfunction of at least one organ. And they further characterized refractory as a lack of response to the administration of a fluid bolus. They specified that that's 30 mils per kilogram of colloids, or if it was determined according to the clinician's assessment of inadequate hemodynamic results, on the basis of values from either right heart catheterization, a pulse pressure measurement, or stroke volume, or echo.
And what was the intervention they were looking at?
So their intervention was a target MAP of 80 to 85 for a max of 5 days.
And the control was a target MAP of 60 to 70 for a max of 5 days.
And what was the outcome in this study?
Primary outcome was death from any cause at 28 days.
With secondary outcomes, including 90-day mortality, days alive and free from organ dysfunction by day 28, length of stay in the ICU and hospital. Serious adverse effects were classified as either ischemic or other.
So the author's conclusion were, quote, no significant difference between the two groups in the overall incidence of serious adverse events. Now, as part of this process, we do a quality checklist for randomized control trials, and there are 11 questions. And I'm going to run through those questions with you. The first question is, the study population, did it include or focus on those in the emergency department?
This was a bit of an asterisk. We actually contacted Dr. Asfar, and he confirmed that only about 2/3 of the study were specific to the emergency department. Table 1 shows that about 66% in both groups were infections from the community, and Dr. Asfar confirmed that the majority of those came through Emerge. The other third were actually ICU patients.
Stuart, nicely done. Going that extra step to contact the lead author is impressive. With regards to the other 10 quality indicators, the answers were all yes. So we're going to jump forward, except we're just going to touch on one, and that is question number 7. Were all the participants unaware of the groups they were allocated to?
Yeah, so this is an important point. So the patients and the research staff and the outcome assessors were blinded to the group allocation. However, the treating clinicians were necessarily unaware of group allocation.
So let's go through the key results.
So there was no significant difference between the groups for mortality at 28 days.
The mortality rate for the high MAP was 36.6% versus 34.0% for the low MAP target. This gave a hazard ratio of 1.07 with the 95% confidence interval crossing 1. They enrolled 776 patients in this study. Can you tell us a little bit more about how they came up with that number?
Yeah, so they determined their sample size of 800 patients, assuming a death rate of 45% based on previous outcomes. This was to provide a power of 80% to show a 10% difference in the primary outcome, with a two-sided alpha of 0.05.
Stu, how about the secondary outcomes?
Again, no difference. So mortality at 90 days showed no difference between the two groups, high blood pressure having 43.8 versus low blood pressure at 42.3. A hazard ratio of 1.04.
What about serious adverse events?
Again, no difference. High pressure group, 19.1% versus low pressure group at 17.8.
So overall, we thought this was a high quality study looking at a clinically relevant topic. I mean, it was good to try and stratify patients based on hypertension. However, the authors noted the challenges in determining a patient's baseline blood pressure. This is important as it may indicate patients who have auto-regulated to a higher baseline MAP and therefore require a higher MAP in treatment of sepsis to perfuse end organs.
So lack of clinician blinding, as we discussed in the checklist, is a threat to validity, but unfortunately this isn't something that can be overcome in this type of study. Another point to note is that the MAP values exceeded the targets in both groups, but were still significantly different from each other.
We thought that a large number of patients were excluded from the study, many because they were not seen within the first 6 hours of presentation. But Dr. Asfar was unable to comment on whether or not there was a trend in the excluded patients that could have resulted this study bias. As well, more than 80% of patients in both groups received steroids, and this is different from clinical practice here in Canada. In addition, about 7% in both groups received protein C.
How about commenting on the death rate of about one-third at 28 days, when the PROCESS trial had about 20% at 60 days. Same thing at 90 days, the death rate was about 40% in this French study and only 30% in the PROCESS trial.
When you compare all of the studies, the higher mortalities across groups seen in the French study might actually be because of different infection profiles at inclusion.
Well, I'll put a table in the blog for all the details.
The other point to note, as Stu mentioned earlier, a number of patients in this study were included out of the ICU. This could contribute to increased mortality, as these patients have presumably already identified themselves as sicker.
In patients with hypertension, higher MAP values resulted in less renal injury and need for renal replacement therapy. Results suggest that other than an increased risk of atrial fib in the high MAP group, there's no significant difference.
Overall, considering the clinical picture is important in determining a target MAP. Patients with uncontrolled hypertension at baseline will likely require higher MAPs to maintain their end organ perfusion. These results suggest that perhaps there's not an ideal target MAP and would support clinical practice of adjusting MAP to target end organ perfusion.
So our conclusions compared to the authors were that we agree that this study does not show superiority. It does not demonstrate a 28-day mortality advantage of a higher targeted MAP in patients with septic shock undergoing resuscitation. But what's the bottom line?
So the ideal target MAP in septic shock is still unclear. Patient factors play a role and care should likely be individualized.
Stop. Before we go any further, I would like to call a consult.
And I'm going to call a consult with Dr. Sunil Upadhyay. He is the infectious disease guru of the Beam Dream team. Welcome back to the SGEM, Sunil.
Thanks, Ken. It's a pleasure to be back.
Now, I've asked you as a consult to comment on this sepsis topic for a few reasons. The first reason is you have a connection to Queen's University.
That's true, I do, Ken. I was in fact a medical student at Queen's University, graduated in the class of 1996, and had I known we were going to be recording this in Quebec City today, I would have in fact brought my blue magnet to wear while we're recording this. Queen's medical students will know exactly what I'm talking about.
Sunil, you also have a leading role in Canadian guideline development, correct?
I do. As the chair of the Standards Committee for the Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians, I work with the CAPE board to vet and approve new guidelines that are submitted to our organization for endorsement.
Now, being the infectious disease guy from Beam, you also have a specific expertise in sepsis. So are you familiar with the paper we're talking about today?
I'm quite familiar with the paper we're discussing today, as well as some of the other important papers that came out in sepsis care in 2014.
So we're calling out this consult so that you can give us a case resolution. And just to remind you, the clinical picture was a 74-year-old man with sepsis.
That's true, and that's a very common problem in Canadian emergency departments. The first step with any of these patients is to have early recognition. This is followed by liberal fluid resuscitation, broad spectrum antibiotics, or at least tailored to those infection causes that you're worried about, and in this case, the use of vasopressors as needed to support blood pressure. This case is an excellent situation of applying evidence-based medicine. This doesn't mean just applying the literature. Aaron and Stuart have done a very good job of critically appraising this manuscript, and I was quite impressed that Stuart actually called up the author for clarifications.
Yes, I was really impressed that Stuart called up the author to find out if the patients in this study were actually in the emergency department.
That would be a very important thing to find out to increase the generalizability of the results of this study to our patient populations. So the literature is just one part of three important aspects of evidence-based medicine that you repeatedly touch on during these podcasts, Ken. You must also take into account the clinical experience of the provider. I'm in the 19th year of my practice now, including my residency, so I would think that I've built up a fair bit of a clinical gestalt to match up with the actual evidence as it evolves in this field. The third component of evidence-based medicine, as we've said, are the patients themselves. Randomized control trials do not address how each patient will respond to a standard treatment. Each patient is a unique individual. The literature can only guide us with what we need to do. This is a fellow who has a history of hypertension. So personally, I might want to keep his mean arterial pressure a little bit higher than the protocol of 65 millimeters of mercury subscribed to in order to maintain perfusion of critical organs. So it's where the literature, clinical expertise, and the patient's unique situation overlap that you will get evidence-based medicine and the best care.
Thanks, Sunil. So, team, what did you put for the case resolution?
Yeah, so the patient receives 4 liters of normal saline in the eMERGE. His resuscitation also includes non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, a central line, and levofed to support a blood pressure. He's then admitted to the ICU for ongoing critical care.
So how are you going to apply this information clinically?
So I think from this study, it's reasonable to consider a MAP above 65, depending on the case. And I think this is something that most practitioners have been doing of their own volition for a while.
So here's what I tell patients. It looks like you have a serious infection. We're going to give you IV fluids. We're going to increase your blood pressure with medications if needed. And we're also going to provide broad-spectrum antibiotics. Your response to therapy will be monitored, and we're going to admit you to the hospital for further care. Well, this brings us to the end of the podcast. All that remains is a Keener contest. And last week's winner was... Jamie Davis from Florida. Jamie is a repeat winner on the SGEM. So I'm going to send him a cool skeptical prize, DS. And what does the DS stand for? Double strength. Jamie knew the core competencies for emergency medicine residents to attain prior to graduation. And the specific recommendations from the guidelines are, in patients who have fallen, evaluate for participating cause of the falls such as medication, alcohol use and abuse, gait or balance instability, medical illnesses, and or deterioration of a medical condition. The other thing is to assess for gait instability in all ambulatory fallers. If present, ensure appropriate disposition and follow-up, including attempts to reach their primary care provider. Congratulations, Jamie. Stu, what's the question for this week?
We've got a doozy for you here, Ken.
A doozy?
Oh, yeah.
I'm just waiting for you to pronounce it.
In what year and by whom was the first non-invasive sphygmomanometer invented?
If you know the answer to this question, then send me an email, thesjam@gmail.com, with Keener in the subject line. The first person to correctly answer Stu's question will receive a cool skeptical prize. Well, we have an upcoming conference at Ski Beam. It's going to be at Sun Peaks Resort in Kamloops, BC. We hope everybody can come, January 26th to 28th. I want to thank Aaron and Stuart for being fantastic guest skeptics. It is great to do another journal club at another great university, Queens.
Thanks, Ken. Great to be here.
Ditto.
Now I'm going to invite Heather Murray up here and ask her if she would like to say anything at the end of the podcast. Yeah. So Heather Murray was responsible for bringing this skeptic to Queen's University. I want to thank you very much, Heather. Do you want to add anything to the end to comment maybe on the great job that Stu and Aaron did?
Evidence-based medicine is something we do really well here at Queen's, and I'm glad to see Aaron and Stuart crushing it on behalf of Queen's University and our local skeptics.
The SJM will be back next week with another critical review of a recent paper, trying to cut that knowledge translation window down to less than 1 year. Until then, can we have our live studio audience give the SJM tagline?
Be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.